Hello everyone, this is Rob Opry at Cider. Today is August 27th, 2019. Welcome to this special ESP Evidence Brief Cyber Seminar, preparatory to the SOTA 15, Effective Management of Pain and Addiction Strategies to Improve Opioid Safety, which will be held in person on September 11th and 12th, 2019. This is the second of three sessions today. It is entitled Managing Acute Pain in Patients with Opioid Use Disorder, and it is presented by Stephanie Veazey, assisted by Kate Mackey and Kim Peterson. And as it's just now exactly 12:30, Stephanie, can I turn things over to you?
Yep, great. Thank you, Rob. So my name is Stephanie Veazey. I'm a research associate with the ESP Evidence Synthesis Program Coordinating Center. And today we're going to be talking about our evidence brief titled Managing Acute Pain in Patients with Opioid Use Disorder on Medication-Assisted Treatment. So as Rob mentioned, I'm joined today by Kate Mackey and Kim Peterson, and we'll each be doing different sections of the presentation, and we'll also be available afterwards for questions. So this slide is an overview of what we're going to talk about today. We'll give an overview of the ESP program and the types of products that we offer. Then we're going to talk about the purpose and goals of the upcoming Opioid State-of-the-Art Conference, or SOTA. And then we'll give an overview of the topic, as well as discuss the findings of our recent report on managing acute pain in OUD patients. And then we'll have time at the end for discussion and questions. Okay, first I wanted to take our other co-author, Donald Bourne, who couldn't be here today, for his many contributions to our report. And I also want to thank our operational partners, Dr. William Becker and Dr. Amy Bonnert, for their contributions as well to defining the scope of this report and providing feedback on the draft report. Okay, this is our standard disclosure that these are our findings and conclusions of the ESP program, and we don't represent the views of the Department of Veterans Affairs or the U.S. government, and that we have no conflicts of interest on this report. Do you mind clicking that again? Having some technical difficulties. Okay, here we go. And with that, I'll hand things over to Kim Peterson, who will provide an overview of the ESP program. Kim?
Thanks, Steph. So yes, I'm going to do the next few slides where I'm going to provide a background on our program and products, starting with a little bit about who we are. So we're an evidence synthesis group. We are embedded within VA, and we're funded by HSR&D. The program was established in 2007, and we have our guiding mission here on the slide, and that is that we are dedicated to producing high-quality evidence synthesis reports to make them available to VA clinicians, managers, and policymakers as they do their important work to improve the health and healthcare of veterans. And we have here on our slide a screenshot of our website and the web address in case you're interested in finding out more information about the program as a whole. Next slide, please. So we have four evidence synthesis centers across the U.S., one in Portland, one in L.A., one in Minneapolis, and one in Durham. And we also have a coordinating center that is located in Portland as well, which is led by VA clinician Mark Helfand and Nicole Floyd, deputy director. And together they manage the national program operations, ensure the methodological consistency and quality of our products, and interface with stakeholders. And also at the coordinating center, we have a group of us, including the three of us on this call, that perform the rapid reviews, and I'll talk about those in a minute when I talk about the kinds of products that we offer. But in general, in terms of our qualifications, our centers are all directed by VA clinicians and also experts in systematic review methodology, all of which having close ties to the agency for healthcare research and quality evidence-based practice center program, as well as the Cochrane Collaboration. Next slide, please. Okay, and so just a little bit about how people use our reports. As part of our ongoing quality improvement efforts, we survey operational partners about how they're using the reviews we produce 3 months after we complete the final report. And this slide provides a summary of the top four uses of our reports. So for guidelines and performance measures, to inform identification of the most effective services and patient outcomes, to inform clinical policies, and then as is the primary focus of the SOTA, to inform setting future research agendas. Next slide, please. So what kinds of products do we offer? We offer a wide variety of evidence synthesis products to meet all kinds of different information needs, and as shown in this table, the products range in their characteristics in terms of their balance of speed, rigor, and scope, and in terms of rigor, we noted here how they differ in terms of whether they follow all the systematic review steps and whether they include critical appraisal and external peer review. And in the row at the top is the standard systematic review, and that is our signature product, the product that we started out the program producing, and it's really the one that best meets the industry gold standard of systematic review methodology. So it's our most comprehensive product. It can cover the broadest scope, and it uses the most methodologically rigorous processes, which then in turn provides the most definitive and defensible answers. So you can see how it has check marks in those three boxes that have to do with its rigor. But then the trade-off, as you can see, is that it takes the longest, so it takes about 9 to 12 months to produce. So since we started the program in 2007, over the years we've developed some additional products to meet other kinds of information needs that are either more urgent, like for the SOTA, and or don't require as much rigor and or critical appraisal. So the rest of the products in the table are typically having a narrower scope, and then some in most cases use abbreviated or streamlined methods so that we can produce them in shorter timelines that range from 2 weeks to 4 months. And so we'll talk about the specific ways that we streamline the methods for this report in the slides to come. So next slide, please. So just to orient you to the type of product that we used for this review that we're going to be presenting on today, that we use the rapid evidence brief method. And so this is it's one of our streamlined approaches. Since the SOTA topic or the SOTA conference was on a shorter time frame, then we used one of our streamlined approaches, which in this case was the rapid evidence brief. We were able to produce it within 4 months. And of our streamlined products, it's the most rigorous. So it does generally follow but streamlines the accepted systematic review methods. So it did include critical appraisal and external peer review. And as I mentioned in the slides to come, then we will be discussing the specific streamlining approaches that we took in for this report. Okay, next slide, please. And so here now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Mackey to give us an overview of the background on the opioid SOTA, as well as the background on the topic that is the focus of this presentation.
Great. Thank you, Kim. So as Kim and Stephanie both mentioned, this report today and the three that we're presenting today were all requested in advance of this opioid SOTA that's coming up next month. And so the goals of the conference itself are fairly broad. Where the ESP comes in is there are three work groups for the conference, and we were asked by each of the work groups to review the state of evidence for a specific set of key questions and determine the relevance of that evidence to the VA population. So here are the three work groups, and the specific work group that this report was for is the work group on managing co-occurring pain and substance use disorders. So for some background on the topic, we highlight this recent paper that was published in JAMA Internal Medicine just last month, which starts out with a clinical vignette that highlights several of the challenges that are associated with acute pain management when patients are taking medications for opioid use disorder. So in the case presented in this paper, there's a man in his 40s who's prescribed buprenorphine for opioid use disorder, and he undergoes an elective hand surgery. He's advised by his surgeon to stop his buprenorphine 2 days before the surgery. After the surgery, he started on oxycodone for pain control, but he quickly goes through that and reports that his pain isn't being well controlled. The surgeon informs him that the surgeon himself is not able to write the prescription for buprenorphine because he's not wavered. The PCP who was prescribing buprenorphine wasn't contacted or involved in the process. And in this case, the patient ended up having a relapse of non-prescribed opioid use. Luckily, he did reconnect with his PCP several months later and was started back on buprenorphine. But this case highlights many of the different ways that acute pain management can be challenging when there's a medication for opioid use disorder involved. And also the fact that it was published just last month highlights that this is a timely issue and there's still some confusion about how best to manage these cases. So for the purposes of this audience, which is very familiar with opioid use disorder and these medications, we mostly on the slide wanted to highlight the definition that we used for acute pain, which we defined as sudden onset, time-limited pain that can vary in intensity, modulating factors, and impact on functionality and quality of life. And there are several challenges that are specific to managing acute pain in all patients who have opioid use disorder, including those who may be on medication. And those challenges include overall higher sensitivity to pain, potentially a need for higher doses of opioid medication for effective pain control. Also, the finding that in general, clinicians may undertreat pain among patients who have a history of opioid use disorder due to fear of medication misuse or perpetuating addictive behaviors. And finally, another challenge is just the different clinical considerations for each type of medication used to treat opioid use disorder and the implications that those medications have for using other opioids for pain management. So here is a table outlining some of the characteristics of the three medications that are approved for treatment of opioid use disorder: methadone, buprenorphine, naloxone, and naltrexone. And again, we are aware that this audience is very familiar with these medications, but we just wanted to highlight some of the clinical considerations that are some of the clinical challenges with use of these medications in an acute pain situation. Starting with methadone, probably the biggest one is that the response to changes in methadone dosing can be unpredictable. So if a patient is admitted for an acute pain reason and their methadose is adjusted, it may not be known how quickly those medications will take into effect. There might be an increased risk for overdose in that setting. With buprenorphine and naloxone, the main challenge here is that there's at least a theoretical risk that if a patient continues their dose of buprenorphine naloxone during an acute pain episode, that the addition of other opioids may not be effective as they would be otherwise because of the specific pharmacologic properties of buprenorphine. And whether or not that's actually true in practice is unknown, but that's at least a theoretical risk. And then with naltrexone, because it blocks the effects of opioids, it is recommended to be discontinued in cases of a planned surgery or planned procedure where an acute pain is expected and opioids may be used to manage it. And the recommendation is to stop naltrexone 30 days in advance. In cases of acute pain or emergent pain, such as with an injury or trauma, naltrexone would obviously still be on board, so in those cases, opioids can't be used. And in that part of reviewing the background of this topic, we looked for guidelines regarding use of all of these medications in the acute pain setting, and we found 2015 American Society of Addiction Medicine does provide some guidelines based on expert opinion using a structured consensus method regarding these three, but there are still some areas that there's lack of clarity, and other organizations like the CDC and the VA and Department of Defense do not provide specific guidelines on management or use of these medications in cases of acute pain. So there are several proposed strategies for how these medications might be continued or adjusted or stopped during an acute pain episode. For methadone and buprenorphine, options include continuing them in their usual dose, dividing the doses, which is thought to potentially provide more effective pain control in divided doses versus the daily dose, and to add opioids and non-opioid pain treatments on top of patients' usual doses of methadone and buprenorphine. And with naltrexone, as I mentioned, generally advised to stop before a planned acute pain episode when that isn't possible because of an emergent condition, non-opioid pain treatments need to be used, or at least theoretically, patients can be treated with higher doses of opioids to try to overcome the effect of naltrexone, and there's a theoretical risk that that may increase the risk for overdose once the naltrexone wears off. So with that, I will turn it over to Steph to describe our report.
Great, thank you. You can find our full-length report on this website, as well as supplementary materials which have additional details on the studies that we included. Okay, so we had two key questions for this report. The first was, what are the benefits and harms of strategies to manage acute pain in adults taking medication for opioid use disorder? And then our second key question was, do these benefits and harms vary by patient characteristics, such as the type of medication or the type of acute pain? So things like whether it was an emergent condition or a planned surgery. Okay, we used specific eligibility criteria when we were evaluating whether a study would be included in this report. So for population, we were only interested in adults. We excluded pregnant women and adults that had opioid use disorder that were taking one of these three medications and that had an acute pain incident. In terms of intervention, we were inclusive of any pain management approach, so that could include discontinuing or changing the dose of a OUD medication, using a different opioid, or using non-opioid therapies, and that would include both pharmacological and non-pharmacological therapies. In terms of comparators, we were interested in any type of comparator, which would include pre-post studies. And in terms of outcomes, we're interested in several patient-important outcomes, pain severity, most importantly, pain-related function, quality of life, other things like patient satisfaction, healthcare utilization. And then we're also interested in addiction treatment-related outcomes, so things like withdrawal, substance use relapse, overdose, as well as adverse events, including suicidal ideation, self-directed violence, or any other type of adverse event. In terms of timing, setting, and study design, we were inclusive of any study regardless of what timing, setting, or study design. Okay, so this provides an overview of the methods that we used. So as Kim mentioned, we used rapid review methods where we streamlined systematic review methods to produce this report on a shorter time frame. So we searched multiple medical databases and consulted with experts to identify articles we may have missed. In terms of study selection, we used the eligibility criteria I mentioned in the previous slide. For data extraction, we used a standard template to pull information out of these studies, and we were looking, we pulled out information on study characteristics as well as results. In terms of critical appraisal, we used standardized tools to assess both the quality of individual studies as well as our confidence in the findings based at looking across studies at the overall body of literature. So we'll talk in more detail about the tools that we used to do our critical appraisal in our next couple of slides. We had a couple of steps in place to ensure quality control. So we had one reviewer review articles for inclusion, extract data, and evaluate study quality. And then those assessments were checked by a second reviewer. And then if there were any disagreements, we had a discussion and then resolved the disagreement through consensus. And then finally, we had a peer review process where a topic or a methodological expert reviewed the report who was outside of the ESP, and we compiled all of their comments and responded to them, and those are publicly available in our supplementary materials as well. Okay, so this this slide gives an overview of the criteria that we use to assess the quality of individual studies. So we had five areas where we were assessing quality or the risk of bias. So bias due to selection of participants into the study, the classification of interventions and departure from those interventions, measurement of outcomes, confounding, as well as missing or unreported data. We would assess these criteria for each study, and then for each study we determined an overall assessment of the quality. So a good quality study would be one that was free of bias. A fair quality study was one that had some potential for bias, and then a poor quality study was one that had major areas of potential bias. Okay, this next slide gives an overview of the methods we use to evaluate strength of evidence. So strength of evidence incorporates quality of studies as well as other characteristics of the body of evidence, and the end result is we give a determination of how confident we are that the findings of the report represent the true effect. So it incorporates methodological limitations, so that was informed by our quality assessment of individual studies, and then also incorporates characteristics of the evidence, including the precision of evidence, the consistency across in findings across studies, as well as the directness of evidence in terms of how applicable and direct it was in addressing our population of interest. And in the end, we determined an overall assessment of the strength of evidence that ranged from either high, where we had a lot of confidence that the findings were representative of the true effect, all the way to insufficient, where there just wasn't enough evidence or the evidence had limitations and we didn't feel confident that we could reach a conclusion. Okay, so this gives an overview of our study results. So we, after searching medical databases, we found about 280 studies and then went through a process of defining which studies met our inclusion criteria, and then we ended up with a total of 8 included studies. So of these 8 studies, we didn't find any that fell into what we would consider the highest tier of evidence. So we did not find any systematic reviews or randomized controlled trials, which would have provided the most rigorous study design to address our questions. However, we did find studies that fell on the lower tiers of evidence. So these were observational studies, 3 of which had control groups and 5 of which did not. And the ones without control groups were either case series or case studies. We did not find any studies that looked at managing acute pain in veterans specifically. We did not find any studies that looked at the management of acute pain in patients that were taking naltrexone. Okay, so this slide gives an overview of the 3 studies that we found that provide the best available evidence on managing acute pain in these patients. So these are the studies that had control groups. So this slide gives an overview of commonalities across the studies. So you can see in that second column that all of these were retrospective cohort studies. The time frame and the duration of the study was quite variable, so ranging from 24 hours after surgery all the way to 2 years after surgery. So in general, these 3 studies looked at surgical patients. One of these studies specified that it was patients that were receiving either a knee or a hip replacement. And then one of these studies included surgical patients as well as patients that had another acute condition, although it did not specify what that condition was. In terms of comparisons, none of these studies compared different acute pain management strategies, which would have provided the most direct evidence to answer our questions. However, they looked at how acute pain was managed in different populations. So in that first row, McIntyre 2013, they looked at managing acute pain in patients that had OUD, so it was comparing patients taking methadone versus those taking buprenorphine. And then the next two studies compared patients that were either had OUD and they were taking medication versus those that did not have OUD, and they looked at the differences in pain management strategies and outcomes in each of those groups. In terms of intervention, we'll go into a little bit more detail in the next couple of slides about what these pain management strategies look like, but this gives an overview that each of these studies essentially gave sort of a global overview of the types of medications that were used and overall doses, but did not provide a lot of detail about sequencing of intervention and specific decision points of when doses were increased or decreased, that sort of thing. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about those soon. And then in terms of outcomes, these studies did look at a number of important patient outcomes like pain, functionality, and quality of life. However, they did not look at things related to addiction treatment outcomes, so none of these studies looked at whether patients eventually had overdose or relapse of OUD. Okay, so we're going to do a deep dive into each of these three studies. So McIntyre 2013, this is the study that looked at surgical patients with OUD taking methadone and compared to those who were taking buprenorphine, and this was up to 24 hours after surgery. The study found that about half of patients taking buprenorphine and 3/4 of those taking methadone received their usual dose after surgery, and that overall most patients used high doses of opioids as well as other types of pain medications. The findings of the study was that both groups had similar outcomes in terms of pain, functionality, and adverse events. However, those that did not receive their usual dose of either buprenorphine or methadone after surgery used more of other types of pain medications for longer periods of time. So there were a number of limitations of this study that should be kept in mind in interpreting these findings. First, the groups, so the methadone versus the buprenorphine group, were different in terms of co-occurring substance use, so alcohol, cannabis, and benzodiazepines, and these differences were not controlled for in the analysis. And then some of these patients had their OUD medications discontinued or their dose was missed, and study authors could not determine why that dose was missed, whether it was intentional or accidental. Okay, so our second study with a control group compared these patients that had knee and hip replacements who had OUD taking medication to those who did not have OUD. So this study unfortunately did not comment on whether the OUD medication was continued. So we don't know what the strategy was in terms of that medication. However, we do know that the OUD medication group received 8 times the opioid dosage at discharge, and that both groups used similar amounts of these other types of pain medications. And in terms of results, they found similar pain, functionality, and quality of life, both at 6 weeks and 1 year after surgery, except that the OUD medication group had worse knee range of motion at 1 year. In terms of limitations, a major limitation is that it was unclear if OUD medication was continued for these patients, increased, decreased. So we don't know any information about that. That's a limitation. We don't know which opioids were prescribed at discharge. And then we also, all the OUD, all the patients taking OUD were grouped together. So patients taking either methadone or buprenorphine were grouped together, one group, and there's no subgroup analysis comparing the different medications. Okay, our last study with a control group that offers the best available evidence looks at patients that either had a surgical or a non-specific acute condition taking methadone compared to those who did not have OUD. So the study commented that 12% of methadone patients taking methadone had their dose increased. However, we don't know for certain why that dose was increased, whether it was a response to increased pain or if it was a otherwise some other decision to increase it. We do know that these groups received similar opioid doses and similar amounts of other pain medications. And the results were that each of these groups had similar reports of pain. So these were how often patients mentioned pain and how often this appeared in the ward notes for their stay. We know that patients with methadone had longer hospital stays and that they were more likely to have behavioral problems, to discharge against medical advice, and to transfer to another hospital. And one of the major limitations of the study is that pain was not assessed through a validated tool, and it wasn't assessed by patients directly. So again, pain was assessed as how often it appeared in the ward notes. So we really don't know whether pain was being effectively managed in these patients that were taking methadone. And then, again, it's unclear why some of these patients had their methadone dose increase and why some did not. Okay, so in terms of bottom line of these three studies, they did have some major methodological limitations, which I mentioned. So the pain management strategies aren't adequately described in terms of timing, dosage, and reason for why changes were made. There were inadequate methods to assess pain severity. In terms of that last study, it's hard to know if pain is being managed in those patients. And then few of these studies reported other patient-important outcomes like relapse and overdose. However, given those limitations, we still feel like there are some lessons that can be learned from these studies, the first of which is that continuing the use of buprenorphine and methadone for patients with OUD after surgery may reduce the need for additional opioids, which was seen in that first study. The second lesson is that patients taking medication for OUD are opioid tolerant and need higher doses of opioid agonists for effective pain control. And that was a lesson we learned from the second study. And then the third lesson is that ineffective management of acute pain in these patients, specifically those taking methadone, can lead to disengagement in care. Okay, this is an overview of the other five studies that we found that did not have control groups. So these are lower on the evidence here. These were generally case studies or individual case series or individual case studies. So in general, these had some pretty substantial limitations. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about these studies except to say they addressed additional populations that we didn't see in the controlled studies. So a number of these looked at managing acute pain in patients with emergent conditions, so either injury or trauma. The second aspect of these studies is that they provide a little bit more detail about timing, dosage, and sequencing of pain management approaches. So they provide a little bit more information about that than what we found in the controlled studies. So the bottom line of this group of studies, they had some critical limitations. Most importantly, there wasn't a concurrent control group which could help establish the causality between a certain pain management strategy and an outcome. A number of these studies were very small. So four of them were single case studies of just one patient. A few of these used validated measurement tools to assess outcomes. And in general are at high risk of both selection and reporting bias. So given all those caveats, we still think there are a couple of pieces of information that can be gleaned from these studies. First, that management of acute pain in emergent conditions can involve some trial and error. So for each of the studies, patients received a couple different types of pain medication or things were switched before adequate pain control was achieved. The second lesson is that methadone can be continued during periods of acute pain, which was seen in our controlled studies, but this was sort of further validated by these studies. And then third lesson is that higher doses of opioids may be needed for patients taking these medications. Again, something that we saw in the controlled studies, but was also seen in these uncontrolled studies. Okay, so in terms of this discussion, we found there's limited evidence supporting any specific pain management strategy for patients taking OUD medications, and our overall confidence is low. So our confidence is low due to these small number of studies that had methodological limitations, and that none of them were in veterans. The evidence we did find, however, supports consensus-based guidelines that Kate mentioned, that methadone can be maintained during acute pain episodes, and that continuing buprenorphine is a reasonable approach with most patients with mild to moderate pain. And finally, there are some research gaps that we identified in our report that should be informed by future research, which I will talk about next. So the first research gap is that we did not find any studies that looked at managing acute pain for patients taking naltrexone. So we really don't know anything from the evidence base about what's the best strategy for managing pain in these patients. The second evidence gap is that we don't know a lot about using non-opioid and non-pharmacological acute pain management strategies for patients taking these medications. And lastly, we still don't know benefits and harms of adjusting the dose or timing of OUD medications. So we really didn't have a lot of detailed information from our controlled studies about this. And then the information that we got from our uncontrolled studies have some limitations. So this is still an area that could be explored in future research. So there are a few limitations, both of the evidence that we identified as well as our rapid review methods. So as I mentioned, we only found lower tier evidence. So these are retrospective cohort studies, case series, and case studies. So that's the best available evidence that we identified. And among those studies, there were methodological limitations, particularly in reporting detailed information about dosage timing and sequencing of these management strategies. In terms of our rapid review methods, we did streamline some steps to produce this report on a short time frame, so it's possible we could have missed eligible studies or study data. However, because our findings align with recent guidelines, we feel that we likely found most of the relevant available literature. Okay, so our conclusions of this report are that there's a lack of rigorous evidence on the management of acute pain in patients taking any of these three medications. Although the evidence we found had important methodological limitations, the best evidence suggests that continuing methadone or buprenorphine during an acute pain episode is a clinically sound approach for most patients that are taking these medications. And lastly, more research is needed that evaluates patient outcomes following well-characterized acute pain management interventions, which includes dose schedule adjustments and the use of non-opioid pain management strategies. Okay, and I'm going to stop there. This is my email address if you'd like to, if you have any additional questions about our report. This is the link where you can find our full report and supplementary material. And I also want to open up the floor to discussion and questions, and then see if our operational partners, Dr. Becker and Dr. Bonnert, are on the line and would like to make any additional comments.
Thanks, Stephanie. This is Will Becker. I'll start with my comments, which is first just an appreciation for the work that you all did at ESP, Kim, Kate, and you. This is really fantastic, really thorough, and with such a quick turnaround. Highly biased observer here, but, you know, this is a really important question that you've highlighted. There remains a real lack of evidence to guide us. In fact, I was a couple minutes late because I had a patient that we have on buprenorphine who fractured his ribs, and he went to the ER, and they told him there was nothing they could do for him. And so the field is really struggling with management questions here. So I don't really have questions. Just really wanted to compliment you all for the work and appreciate the effort that went into this, and I think it'll be a helpful guidepost for where we need to head with designing studies to answer some of these questions.
Thank you.
There are no pending questions at this time. Audience members, you're probably familiar with how to submit questions, but as a reminder, there's a section in the GoToWebinar dashboard on the right-hand side of your screen entitled Questions. You can go ahead and type any question that you have into that section, and I will read it to our presenters. At this time, Stephanie and Kim or Kate, if you have any closing comments or anything else you'd like to include, I think this would probably be a good opportunity.
I don't think I have any additional comments. Thank you for listening, and we enjoyed working on this report.
Thank you. There are no questions at this time. I'd just like to remind everybody before we close that there will be one more session this afternoon at 2 o'clock entitled Benefits and Harms of Long-Term Opioid Dose Reduction and Discontinuation in Patients with Chronic Pain, which will be presented by Kate and assisted by Kim. Thanks, everybody. I'll go ahead and close this webinar now.
Thank you.
Thank you.